As the United States is working to pull itself out of a recession, many believe that the burgeoning economies of India and China will make a full recovery much more difficult. Not so, says Adam Siegel, who believes that U.S. innovation is the key to the continued strength of this country. Mr. Siegel is the Ira A. Lippman Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism and National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, Advantage, How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge, is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
So how does an expert on counterterrorism and national security issues come to write a book about American technological innovation?
Well, the focus on counterterrorism came later, actually. I was, for the last 20 years, I've been looking at Chinese technology policy. And it is only recently that I've started focusing on cybersecurity. So I had a change in titles.
Don't recent economic indicators in the United States offer little hope for a full recovery anytime soon? Why do you say there's reason for optimism in the United States?
I think things do look like they're going to be difficult, but I think we've often forgotten what our core strengths are, and we are overly focused on what seems to be the strengths in India and China. In the book, I make a distinction between what I call the hardware of innovation and what I call the software. And the hardware is things that are easy to see and easy to measure. And so that's why every two or three weeks we get an article about how many patents there are in China or how many engineers they're graduating or how fast the maglev train is. These are all important measurements, but they're not the whole story for innovation. And the software is the social, political, cultural understandings that help move ideas from the lab to the marketplace. And those are underdeveloped in Asia, and those are one of our great strengths.
But they don't produce as much money, do they? I was thinking about the old story of video recording, which was invented in the United States. But the Japanese and Koreans made most of the money from it because they provided the machines that people bought for home use.
Well, it's a little bit reversed now. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Chinese are so incredibly focused on innovation themselves, is because if we buy a DVD player now, for example, at Best Buy or someplace, let's say it's $30. The DVD player, 90% of the world's DVD players are made in China. But the
Japanese have lost that manufacturing capability as well?
They've lost that. The manufacturing all takes place in China. But the optical reader, the core technology, that is Siemens, Toshiba, other foreign U.S. companies, Japanese companies. So when the Chinese sell that DVD player, about $3 of the sales price goes to the IPR holders, to the holders of the patent rights. And the margins for the Chinese producers are very, very thin. So the Chinese companies are very, very worried about being stuck in that trap. It does generate jobs, which is a different story.
And that's part of our problem with the economic recovery. Manufacturing, the United States has lost most of its manufacturing capability. And in the past, that's where most of the jobs were.
That's right. And I think one of the things that I focus on in the book is how do we start generating new companies and new jobs? And so, you know, you hear a lot about Cisco and Intel and Microsoft and how they're doing. And they're doing fine, actually. That those companies are very well positioned to deal with this new world of globalized innovation. And they're doing great. They're doing fairly well in China. They've taken advantage of globalization of innovation. So I'm much less concerned about the state of those companies. But I think what we need to focus on is how do we generate jobs and how do we support these small startups? And so in the book, I tell these stories of how places like Maine and Arizona and other places around the country are trying to help new young scientists start new companies. And that generates new jobs, and that also generates new manufacturing skills.
My guest is Adam Siegel. His book, Advantage, How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. It's published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about Maine for a moment. Maine realized that its major source of revenue was dying out, and so the state came up with a new policy.
Yeah, basically, Maine said, well, the old model was let's try to get big companies to relocate here, have them set up factories, and we'll hire people. But Maine found itself to be particularly uncompetitive in that type of competition because of tax policy and a widely accepted view that Maine was inhospitable to big companies.
It's also cold.
It's cold.
Far from the rest of the country.
It's rural. It's an older population. A lot of young people leave. That's the other main problem that Maine had, is that most young people leave to go to Boston or someplace that seems more vibrant. And so Maine decided, well, how do we rewrite that story? How do we start creating our own industries? And they said, well, what are we good at? What do we have that's already here? And of course, yacht building, shipbuilding was an obvious place for them to look at. They had scientists at the University of Maine who were experimenting with different new types of composite materials. So, well, if we try to build an industry around that, if we take composite materials, we expand on yacht building, how can we grow that? And these composite materials are now being used in the ballistic shields for the tents in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're helping with building new piers. And that is the type of focus that I talk about in the book.
Well, you're saying to some degree that the way we teach science is perhaps slightly misguided, that we're teaching it very much in pure scientific terms, and we should be teaching it in terms of developing these kinds of things?
Well, I think one of the things that happens
is –
A more practical application, and also to create more career paths. And because if you're the story we always hear is that Americans are uninterested in science and they're uninterested in math, which is not exactly true. If you look at most surveys of freshmen who come into college, about a third of them say, well, actually, no, I am interested in science or math. But they're often interested in doing environmental policy or something that's more – starting their own company or something that's more hands-on. The academic career for science doesn't give them those opportunities. So everyone always talks about, well, how many PhDs do we have? But PhDs, for the most part, don't start companies, right? They don't create jobs. And so one of the things to do is to not only think about what type of science do undergraduates do, how do we get them engaged in more practical experiences, but also what other career paths are out there? Do you have to get a PhD?
But haven't there been concerns about how our universities have been too involved with industry, in some cases actually making poor scientific decisions because they were working for major corporations, big pharma?
That's right. There have been these cases where entire departments have said, well, we're going to work with this one company, or we're going to work on this one area. But I think the way to get around that is to focus on these departments as platforms, right, for a whole range of technologies and ideas.
Well, Stanford has worked rather well with Silicon Valley and supplied Silicon Valley with many of its best people. In fact, that's why Silicon Valley is located where it is.
That's right. And I think,
Boston's another area because of MIT and the other colleges there.
The Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, Austin. So all these places are doing, I think, the right thing. And it's very hard for other places to recreate that.
But should the U.S. government be involved? How much blame can we put on the lack of funding in the U.S. for scientific and technological research?
Partly. I think some of the blame is there. I think if you look, for example, at funding for the physical sciences, chemistry, physics, those have been flat. And especially if you're worried about manufacturing and new materials, those need to be increased. But that was increased. President Obama signed the America Competes Act, which is going to double the budget for the National Science Foundation. It's going to increase funding in there. But I think
I'm assuming that some people in Congress are going to try to change that.
Well, Republicans have not made it clear about what of that $100 billion that they were talking about cutting, how much of it they're going to see as expendable. I think that's an important argument to make, that these are investments, right, not unnecessary spending.
A number of states have decided not to take federal funds for high-speed rail.
Right.
Others have said this puts us even further behind the rest of the world in developing important new technologies. The Chinese are building a lot of new fast trains.
Well, I think there's two points that need to be focused on. One is, I think we don't want to get caught up in how much money is being spent. Spending is important, but clearly in this recessionary stage and budget deficits, it's going to be harder for people to get that money. So a lot of the things that are being done in Maine and Arizona and these other places actually doesn't take that much money, and it isn't spending driven, right? Big part of Silicon Valley has to do about networks and connecting young scientists and young entrepreneurs together. A lot of that is just social. It isn't necessarily just spending.
Well, we've been talking about China and India, but what about some European countries? For example, Germany, which has put a lot of money into subsidizing the development of solar panels and putting solar energy all over the country.
Right. Well, one of the things that would be certainly very good for us would be get our energy policy into place. Right. Once the prices are set in the market, then our model, I think, will kick in. A bottom-up growth model of entrepreneurs will then have a kind of consistency that they can focus on. But the point is also is not that the United States has to dominate every single technological sector. It's that is going to be impossible. And one of the things that we have to get our mind around is that other countries innovating, of course, is clearly good for us and is good for everyone. Right? When I get a headache, I don't really care that the Germans who invented took a French invention and commercialized it and made aspirin. So the United States has to be positioned to be able to take advantage of those innovations that happen in other places.
Weren't many of the innovators working in India and China trained in this country?
Many of them were. They came to the States either as graduate students or they came and they worked on their first companies here.
And for a long time, the countries they were coming from complained about the brain drain. Should we be worried about a new kind of brain drain?
I think what we should be worried about is that if we don't continue to attract the best. I think the fact that these people are going back, some people have called this brain circulation now, right? It's no longer brain drain. Because a lot of these people who have gone back to China and India, their companies exist in this world between China and the United States or India and the United States. You can see them on the flights, right, between Shanghai and the United States. They're going back and forth all the time. And I think they bring benefit to both. They clearly improve the innovative capabilities of China and India. They bring all of this knowledge, right? How do you start a company? When do you release, version 2.0? When do you get venture capital? All of these skills that take a long time to develop, they learned in the United States. But they're constantly connected to the United States. They're looking at U.S. markets. They're interested in U.S. consumers. And the U.S. is really well positioned to take advantage of those people. We still have all of these strong ties to them, which I think really helps us in the world.
The news recently revealed that Shanghai had scored best in, I guess it was science scores, although then the next thing we heard was that's because they rely on rote learning. So is rote learning bad? Are we doing it a better way because we encourage people to think outside the box?
Well, I think you can see the Chinese themselves are worried about their educational system, right? They themselves have said, we have too much rote memorization. We have too much focus on these exams. We have most of our students, in fact, have the inability to work together on large projects. So there is something to be said that the U.S. system, which encourages a great deal of individual initiative and more creativity, is better match to these focuses on entrepreneurship.
On the other hand, how much of a problem is the United States public school system where students are way behind students all over the world in math and science?
Yeah, I mean, there's no getting around that K-12 is a major issue for the United States and one that we need to address. I think the issue for the entrepreneurship and for starting new companies is that the U.S. still has a very deep bench. Right, and one of the great strengths that we've always had is at the university level, and that we've always managed to attract the best and the brightest from abroad. Immigration policy has now been getting in the way of that, and so that is one of the things that I talk about in the book that really needs to make sure that we get right. And K-12 is one of the things we need to get right.
We're keeping smart people from other countries coming to the United States now to go to our schools.
In those cases, it's not so much that we're keeping them out. We're just not making it very easy for them to stay. There have been some cases where people's work has gotten them into trouble when they've tried to come to the States. But the larger issue is that once they graduate, how easy is it for them to get a green card, or how easy is it for them to work for citizenship? And what type of opportunities do they have abroad at home? And that's been a major concern.
My guest is Adam Siegel, the Ira A. Lippman Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism and National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's written for the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and other publications, and has a new book called Advantage, How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. It's published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Adam Siegel. His book, Advantage, How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. It's published by Norton. Aren't India and China intrinsically at an advantage simply because their populations are larger than the United States?
They're going to be bigger. I don't think there's any doubt about that, that the prediction dates for when the Chinese economy is going to be bigger than the United States keeps getting shifted forward. Right? We used to say 2020, now people are thinking 2017 or 2015. But bigger is not the same thing as innovative. And I think one of the things we overlook is the massive barriers that both those economies face to kind of modernizing and how do you move up the value chain. So bigger, yes, but not necessarily more innovative.
But aren't they just going through the same kinds of transitions that the West experienced at the start of the Industrial Revolution, with the advantage of also having some people who know what's going on in the West right now?
That's true, but we've had other economies that have reached the point of these mid-level economies and then basically plateau. Latin America in the 80s, the 70s and 80s.
But Brazil is going through another boom.
It is, but it's still not right now generating a great deal of innovation. It's growing. Both these economies are going to continue to grow, but they're not generating what we would call science-based, new-to-the-market innovations.
Well, but I wonder about those innovations. If the United States innovates and then other people then use those innovations to produce products, which is – we are getting the money from the patents, but we're really – that's a very limiting source, isn't it?
Well, that's why I think the manufacturing sector that we talked about earlier is still such a key part of this story.
Well, why are we allowing our manufacturing sector to totally die? There doesn't seem to be any policy designed to keep it going. In fact, if anything, we seem to be encouraging more and more companies to leave and set up shop elsewhere.
Well, again, I would make the distinction between the big companies and the small companies. Big companies, I think, as you said, the policies are very much distorted towards helping them move abroad. And I think that is a natural process of globalization. They want to be close to their consumers. They want to be close to the markets that they're going to play into. And there's not a lot of, I think, a great deal of hope that they're going to shift manufacturing back here, although there have been some notable cases. With the smaller companies, though, they tend to be located locally. They tend to hire locally. They tend to scale up locally. So I think in those cases, the benefits of innovation are much more likely to be captured by American workers.
Allison from the Bronx left a comment on a show page. She says, America is full of innovators and inventions, but the patent system in this country is still out of whack, especially for tech and biological innovations.
That's right. And one of the things I talk about in the book is a shift away from, especially from the universities, a focus on how many patents a professor produces or how many patents the technology office of those universities are producing. And so a greater focus on how do you pull patents, how do you have more sharing, how do you have them more open so more people are able to move and generate them. And also some degree of modesty from the United States. We've been going around the world pushing our kind of patent model on other people. But in fact, it's bottling up a lot of innovation.
That listener also notes that some scientists and engineers are funding their own research by way of their commercial patents.
Well, I think we want to – I mean, that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing in my mind, in the sense that we want those – we want people to be able to – who can want to start a company to be able to fund that company. The traditional way has been – you raise some money from the three Fs, you know, family, friends, and fools. And then you hope to grow a little bigger and attract venture capital, and then you go from a public to a public share. So if
and then you get sued by the people who
say they own your IP.
Yeah, and you pay them off $65 million, but they pursue it even further.
Exactly. So if you have more avenues, I think, to building the companies, in my mind, that's a better thing.
In May 2007, President Bush issued a statement on open economies that supported international investment here and American investment worldwide. Has President Obama continued that openness policy?
He has not been as open about that as I would have hoped. He wrote a op-ed soon after he took office and said, yes, the U.S. is open for business and we welcome foreign investment. But I think there is a great deal of suspicion in the United States, especially if that money is coming from China or from the Middle East. But I think we have to, with the right security provisions in place, get over that. And one of the things that would actually be good for the United States is for more of that investment to come here. For we saw that actually in Phoenix with the Chinese solar manufacturer setting up shop there. So those are the kind of things that the United States needs to do, encouraging more of.
We think of the economic crisis as something recent, but 4 years ago, President Bush asked Americans to shop more to pump up the economy. Does that kind of advice actually have any impact?
No, and I think, unfortunately, that was the exact wrong advice we needed to give at the time. We, you know, Americans were already consuming too much as it was. We had some slow decline in consumption with the recession, but that seems to be peaking up again. So U.S. household savings are back to zero, basically. I think President Obama has been better, and that in his many of his first public discussions about the economy, he talked about shifting us from being consumers of things to makers of things. He talked a lot about trying to promote a kind of geek chic, right? People that invent things and innovate things. But I don't think he's gone far enough. I think he's been focused on other things right now.
How have American companies like Microsoft learned to work within China? You mentioned that Microsoft was doing that. I guess a few other major corporations. You said Cisco?
Cisco, yes. A lot of the U.S. companies in China, I think, have been very short-sighted. They've made a bet that the more open they are to China, the more, in fact, that they help Chinese companies, the more involved that they are in the Chinese economy, that they will eventually be able to reap those benefits. So you see companies like Cisco and Microsoft heavily investing in Chinese universities, trying to develop connections with research labs there, with helping small startups there, all of which make a great deal of business sense and give those companies a very good PR in China.
Well, so with their thinking more about collaboration and less about the kind of competitive sensibility that had people worrying that other countries would steal our technology.
Well, I think they know that the technology is going to be stolen in China, but they think that they can keep running as faster than the Chinese competitors are. I think they also – the Chinese government has been very good at sending the message that if you're a friend of China, then we are going to help you out. And a friend of China is someone who transfers technology. And if you're not a friend of China, then we're going to make things difficult for you. The problem is that the Chinese constantly redefine what the definition of a friend is. And they've made it very clear that the Chinese have made it very clear that they want their own companies to compete in all those sectors, right? They don't want to rely on Microsoft or Cisco forever. And they want Huawei and Chinese software companies to eventually compete. So while Microsoft and Cisco in the short term are developing these relationships with the Chinese government, in the long term, the Chinese government's ultimate goal is to promote Chinese companies.
And look the other way when some companies do things like counterfeit American products. There's an awful lot of intellectual theft.
Not only just look the other way, but in some ways encourage it. So by not following up and prosecuting IPR violations, by in many ways encouraging Chinese firms to re-engineer Western technology. So creating an environment that is incredibly hostile to Western technology rights.
And the Chinese political system, some people say, puts them at an advantage because democracies have to work in a more open way.
I think, you know, it puts them at an advantage for building highways and for building high-speed rail because you can move people out of the way without much protest, right? They can't go to the courts. They can't go to the media for the most part. But over the long term, I think it's going to be very harmful to the Chinese economy. I think the top-down system of innovation hasn't worked. The Chinese themselves are fairly nervous that having state-led, top-down policies that are focused on specific technology goals hasn't worked. And they themselves are trying to foment a kind of more bottom-up, entrepreneurial-driven technology model. But they're caught between two worlds. They're very comfortable with telling people what to do. So I think in the mid to long term, it's a major barrier for them.
Well, since they don't have total internet openness, that also, I imagine, puts a certain crimp on their ability to be more innovative.
This is one of the big questions that arose with the Google incident. Right? People said, well, if you don't have a Google or if Google is going to pull out at the full openness, then what's going to happen to China's innovative capabilities? Short term, I don't think it's a major problem, right? Because Chinese firms have actually done very well in the Chinese domestic market. They were competing very rigorously with Google. Baidu has done very well in the Chinese market. Again, I think these are longer term concerns. I think the Chinese themselves, you saw a lot of debate in the Chinese press that Google leaving was going to mean that Baidu was going to have a monopoly power. They're going to become less innovative. And Chinese scientists were very worried because they were relying on Google Scholar to collaborate with other Western scientists.
If China were smaller, it probably wouldn't be able to get away with some of the things it gets away with. But is the United States economy just too tied to the Chinese economy for us to have much leverage when they do some of the things that we might consider unethical?
Leverage is a very difficult problem in the U.S.-China relationship. The image that I always use is two people with their hands around each other's neck going over the waterfall together. That the Chinese are very dependent on American consumers. Right? We're the ones that were buying all the things that the Chinese produced. We, of course, are still incredibly dependent on the Chinese because they're buying all of our treasury bills and all our debt. The Chinese, though, are still very dependent on us for technology. They are still relying on us. And so I think that is a source of leverage for us. I think we have, for the most part, been very hesitant to use it. But it is the one issue that when we have pushed back on, we have gotten some traction.
Well, we know Americans are panicked about the threat from Asia. We earlier had Americans panicked about the Japanese growth of business, and the Japanese have since had serious problems. Mm-hmm. What do Asian business leaders think about America's status regarding technology?
I think Asian leaders are actually much more optimistic about the United States in the technology sector than Americans are. Last year, there was a survey that asked Chinese and Americans, you know, which is the most innovative economy. Americans said China. The Chinese said America. And so on my first trip to India, this was probably 2006 or 7, I'm talking to some Indian software magnate, and he basically looked at me and said, "You Americans are crazy. You keep coming over here and telling us how you're losing your innovative edge to us, and we're going to soon pass you." And he said, "We have major, major problems. We're still a very poor country. We have all these issues. You guys need to have some more confidence in what you can do."
In your book, you talk about the U.S. becoming a smart grid rather than a dumb grid. Can you explain that?
Yeah, we use smart grid when we're talking about the next wave of electrification and how can we conserve energy and how can we distribute energy. And so a smart grid is basically a network that's constantly monitoring itself, that knows what's going out and what's coming in. And
right now we just simply send out all the electricity that we create?
We basically, yes. We send it out, we generate it, we send it out, and the ability to moderate how much is being used in certain areas it doesn't exist in the system. It just is sent out and kind of shifted around. And we have leakage along the way. We don't know what's going in. It's basically just sent out. So a smart grid would allow you to basically send both ways. So the metaphor with power generation is if I had solar panels on my house, when I had enough energy for my house, I could resell that back to the grid.
Well, this brings us back to some countries subsidizing the development of green energy technologies. The United States is lagging far behind, aren't we?
It is, but the metaphor would be that the United States, because it has these incredibly well-developed networks and connections, that we would be able to know not only what technology we've been sending out into the world, which is the model that we generally have, right? It's invented and then it's commercialized and then manufactured in some other country, but also that there are going to be breakthroughs. There are going to be discoveries in these new labs in China and India, and we have to be aware of them. We have to be ready to commercialize them ourselves, to manufacture them in the States if that's even possible. And so that means having, you know, U.S. businesses, U.S. venture capital, U.S. graduate students involved in Chinese, Indian, Japanese science and sending those messages back.
Are there any aspects of this current recession that have actually been helpful to innovation?
I think it's too early to tell, but I think that probably the most likely one is the sending of messages to the job market, right? So when at the height of the real estate bubble and the financial market was the smartest and brightest people went into innovation, but it was financial innovation, right? They were creating new derivative swaps and whatever the case might be. So,
and bringing down the economy.
And bringing
as
down
a
the economy. So to the extent that now people think, well, one, either those markets don't exist or they're not as attractive to me, and I can use my technical, mechanical, mathematical skills in doing something else. And I think you've seen that. I think you've seen a rebirth in people starting their own companies.
But it's my sense that you're saying this is very much on the being done on the local level, states like Maine, rather than as a matter of some federal policy.
I think federal policy has a role to play. We talked about investment in R&D, but I think what localities do is much more important. What states and cities and regions do to make sure that all the pieces are in play plays a much larger role.
Well, I remember when Ed Koch was very proud of the fact that we were losing our manufacturing sector because it meant the city was moving to a higher level. I suspect that future mayors will be happy to see some of those manufacturers come back. Is there a way to do that?
Well, I think there's some interesting things actually happening in New York. So we see a group like Hack New York, which is an attempt to take these people I talked about earlier with the mathematical skills who would have gone to Goldman Sachs and say, you know, come work for the summer at one of these new technology startups.
Adam Siegel's book is called Advantage: How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. It is published by Norton. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been fascinating.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org, New York Public Radio.